Yonit, this is to your post-nap L'chaim.
You know, I had a coffee and now I have a shot. It kind of balances out.
We didn't name the shot.
Oh, we didn't.
It's blue.
It's blue. And it tastes like grapefruit.
And it's blue.
It's a blue grapefruit.
And it's a blue shot. And it says, on a shot glass, it says, I'm not drunk, I'm still drinking, that I got from my mystery Maccabee. So, L'chaim.
If you have a name for our drink, leave us a comment.
L'chaim. L'chaim. I'm Jessica.
And I'm Yonit.
Welcome to the Kiddush Book Club. So I also got from Mystery Maccabee, Gin Austin.
We've used this before.
Like, isn't it great?
I've used recipes from it before. I looked it up.
Yeah.
On our Jane Austen episode, we used recipes from it.
So I'm so excited. We have a whole book. Yeah, now we have the whole book. Thank you, Mystery Maccabee. I'm going to know your name. Thank you, Tamar. Like, I'm so happy. I opened the box. And I was like, what is this box that shows up 5 minutes before Shabbos? Yes. Thank God it was 5 minutes. I opened it up and everything in it brought me joy. I was so happy. I love playing with Mystery Maccabee
stuff. I will say we didn't like the Earl Grey with gin in it.
Yeah, we tried making that. I think you have to make an Earl Grey syrup.
Right. You can probably buy a syrup too.
Right. Like, I'm thinking of like making some of these syrups just to have around and then, you know, see what happens from that.
So I've had good gin drinks that are mixed. See, I like sweet drinks, first of all. I know you like a little sourness.
I do.
A little bite to yours.
Yeah, I like a little jalapeno.
I don't mind that, but like I found gin was too bitter for me. So it needs something to counteract the bitter.
Yeah. Well, I find that the more I drink this, the more the blue raspberry syrup mixes.
Oh, I didn't notice this.
So every time I drink it, it's like I tip the cup, put it back, and the blue mixes a little more. Like when I first poured this, the blue sat on the bottom. Yes. And now it's really mixed in.
Yes.
Which, you know, because we're lazy mixers, we just kind of put it in the glass.
Right, we didn't shake it.
We don't shake it. We don't do any work.
No roadhouse.
No.
Flips.
And I know, like, some people are more bespoke when it comes to making their cocktails, and I want to be one of those people.
Are you going to do a Roaring Twenties party for New Year's and make bespoke cocktails?
Well, I'm going to be at a Roaring Twenties dinner.
Okay.
And so and the hosts make fantastic bespoke cocktails. So I feel like maybe, and then this actually brings up, yeah, a little Great Gatsby. I already have my sequin dress. I feel like this should actually take us to, Great Gatsby, to the topic of the day, which is food and books and cookbooks.
Right.
Yes, food.
So, yeah, I mean, there's iconic scenes in some of our favorite books that revolve around food.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's just cookbooks that are fun to read. So
yeah, well, let's start with the iconic scenes.
Yeah.
What are your favorites?
I don't know if I say favorite, but the ones that stick out in my mind are like the Tolkien and Redwall. So Tolkien and Brian Jacques Redwall, they both like dabble in the like, now we're going to, and I think Dickens and Victor Hugo do the same thing.
With Dickens does it a lot.
There's going to be 3 pages of description of all the food on this table. But why?
Exactly. Well, so we've discussed this a little bit before, that the purpose of food in a book has many purposes. Sometimes it's just to show the kind of eater the person is or how starving they must have been before they arrived, right? Like they have been on the road for long. Or extravagance.
It communicates the extravagance.
Right. Yeah. It can communicate, you know, that you have nothing or that you are in a place where you finally have. Yeah. It can communicate like a slave girl and now she's like the princess and the pauper and she's like being fed a million times a day. And she's like, oh my God, why? These people are crazy. Who can eat this much, right?
Nancy is my capitone.
Yeah. All you have to have food.
That's how much they eat.
For teenagers all day long. I have now a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old in my house, which means they're eating all day.
How often does a YA book include eating?
So I brought one with me. I've talked about Ivy's book before, North of Happy.
Yeah.
But because it's a book about a chef, I don't think it counts.
But
every chapter opens with a recipe. I mean, the prologue has a recipe for the perfect pork taco.
Because I'll tell you, the amount that teenagers eat is not reflected in their literature. Right? Like,
they should be eating all the time.
They should be eating so much more often.
Yes, they should be grabbing food from the pantry on their way to their crazy hijinks.
Right, exactly.
Right. Like, I knew that I was going to chase after the girl I love, so I grabbed 4 bags of Lay's.
I took a rotisserie chicken and ate it on the way there.
A whole chicken. I did not share. And then it would be clever. When I arrived, she asked me why I smelled like chicken. It was while I was driving by a QC. Wipe my hand on my pants. Yeah. And they could totally have fun with that. And that's really a character trait.
That's legit.
So, yeah, that's more legit. That's more about being realistic to the day of a YA person.
So I've mentioned this book before, but I really, really liked it. Fever King, the book I read, it takes place in like a post-apocalyptic near future, but obviously there's teenagers in it because in the post-apocalypse time, our only hope is teenagers.
Apparently. Yeah.
But one of the characters is a refugee. And so he manifests magical powers because he survives a magical plague, which is what's killing off most people is this magical plague. And if you survive, then you now have a magical power. So he's now moved into this training center and he does describe everything he eats because he contrasts it with his time of not having,
yeah.
And like how these people are pushing around food on their plate.
Like in the Hunger Games.
We never had. And it's funny because he's constantly trying not to waste food and yet not like disgusted at the excess. And so, like, there's a lot of him, like, not enjoying the food he's eating.
Oh, my God, that's so Jewish.
and he's Jewish.
And he's Jewish. Sense. Actually, that does make sense. The Jewish thing is, like, to be disgusted at the excess, but also to have to not want to waste it. Like, oh, my God, why is there so much food? Why is there so much food? But then on the other end, you're the cook, and you're going, I have to make too much food. Because
what if there's not enough?
What if there's not enough?
I'm hungry.
It's this desperation.
If I make this two kinds of chicken, if someone doesn't like chicken, then I should also make something with ground beef in it. And then if there's a vegetarian. And then, like, you know,
by the end of it, you go three proteins, right? You need three proteins.
You definitely need
three. And one of the proteins has to be gluten free, like, can't be wrapped in a pastry or breaded,
right?
Or soy or peanut.
We do this.
Yes, or sesame. So basically, you just like roast something,
right?
That's a good trick, is to just stick something under a broiler in a smoker. My husband got a smoker. Can I just interrupt to say that my husband got a smoker and
is it in a filing cabinet?
It looks like I understand now why that person was able to make a filing cabinet into a smoker, which is genius.
Genius.
Because it's basically shaped the same way. Like, it's shelves, and the bottom shelf is where you put, you know, whatever, the wood chips. It is so, we had the best smoked roasts on Shabbos. They were so good. And I was like, he was so proud of himself. He would like, he made no mess because the smoker is not kept in the kitchen. It's kept outside.
Yes.
So it was like, I didn't even see any of it. It didn't interrupt my Shabbos cooking. And in the end, I didn't have to make the protein because he was proud of it. And he volunteered to make it every. Yes. And it took, it's like putting something in a crock pot. You walk away. You don't come back. You're ready to take it out.
Yeah.
Oh, and he goes, I'll make it every week.
Yes.
Like, oh my God. Man. I literally, my dad cooks a lot. And so my mom has gotten a little bit of a break over the years after all those years of being the mommy cooking. As my dad learned to cook, she was like, this is great. And now on Thanksgiving, she's, I'm like, what'd you make? She goes, I didn't set the table.
Nice.
So I strive.
Dude, when you're the matriarch of a family, like, that should be your place in life.
Yes. You should be. Listen, my dad enjoys it more than she does. He enjoys watching people eat something that he made and going, did you like it? Did you like it?
Where's
my mom
ever
asked? It is. Yeah. Her food is just as delicious, but she doesn't say, like, does everyone like the chicken? Like, it doesn't occur to her that she should care as much. Yeah. And he's like sitting there watching you take every bite and asking. And my husband does the same thing. So
yeah, that's cute.
I'm excited. What else can I teach him to make? Ooh. What else can he teach himself to make?
So it's interesting. There's a line between baking and cooking.
Okay.
So I've noticed that I read a lot of books where there's baking involved.
Yes.
It's like the scene in the kitchen.
And rom-coms. Baking.
There's always baking. It's a lot of baking. So I actually started writing down, like, there's a Jen McKinley wrote the Cupcake Bakery Mysteries. But, like, that wasn't the only cupcake mystery series I read. There's, like, a lot of them where the main characters.
I believe that.
And then I read one. Oh my gosh, this was amazing. And I have to look it up because I cannot remember what it was called. But it was by the same author who wrote The Glass Magician. Charles something, I think.
I'll never read all the books, Yoni.
I know. So it's the premise of the book is that this woman is a baker. But when she, whatever her intention is when she bakes it, she infuses the food with that. So if you eat a cookie where she was infusing with hope, then you like perk up a little bit, or energy, or love.
Oh.
Like, it makes you feel. So it turns out that there's a reason. Like, it's not just the baking is good. It's that she really does have some magic that she's leaking into her baking as she bakes it.
That's
and it
the
kind
best.
Of goes on.
Bake with love.
And then it kind of, I don't want to do spoilers, but it kind of, think about in fairy tales.
Yeah.
There's a lot of magical food.
Yes. there is a lot of stuff it's where
it's poisoned, or it makes you big, or it makes you small, like, or liquid it makes luck, you sleepy, right? It comes to life.
Yes, like Liquid Luck, where he's convinced he took it, but he didn't, right? Like in Harry Potter. There's always that, yes, but there also is the magical food, right? You eat the beans, and they're magical beans, or, you know, and I, even in the book I wrote, I for sure, I don't want to spoil anything, but I also have someone who can infuse her baked goods. And she's like, no, 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 I just love baking. It's not that I'm putting love and passion. It's, come on, you're really, you are. But there's a lot of food in there. But also we talked a little bit about culture coming in. Yes. I wrote a Jewish book and I want to have them cooking for Shabbos.
Right.
And I have them fighting over if they like potato or lakshan kugel. I have them talking about sweet and sour tongue and how it's their new favorite food, like the smell of dill in the chicken soup. These are cultural experiences that you can relate to, because while you're reading it, you'll go, yes, and in my house, I smell curry on the, this week. You know, so that's kind of when I read a book with other people's cultures, I love to read about their food.
Yes.
Because it makes me think of my food.
Yes.
Wait, are you potato or lakshan?
Okay, so here's the thing in my, okay, this is a funny story.
Sure.
So my potato kugel is shredded potatoes, and my potato latkes
yum, are my blender. Favorite. Okay.
My lakshan kugel is milking.
Wait, wait, wait. Your latkes are pureed, but your kugel is shredded. You don't do a combo in your latkes?
No.
Okay.
So this is, it's my family tradition. That's how it is. So my mom's, so my great grandmother had a milked lakshan kugel recipe.
Okay.
Okay. So I took this recipe. It was handed down from my great grandmother.
Of a milked lakshan kugel. Milk very common. Yes.
With cottage cheese and raisins and cinnamon and everything.
All the noodles.
I'm like, this is amazing. This is my family recipe. Mom, can you, you know, send me a copy of the recipe? Because I want to make it. I want to make sure I get it right. Where is this recipe from that's been handed down from my great-grandmother?
Nestle Tollhouse.
Betty Crocker.
Yes, exactly.
It's the Betty Crocker cookbook from 1950-something.
Oh, my God.
So, but okay.
It's the friends episode. It's the friends episode with the joke.
I know.
My God, you need. That's amazing.
It's still, I was a little bit let down. But at the same time, like, Betty Crocker cookbook from 1950 is still legit. That's a long time ago.
It is.
And it's been in my family for a long time. Like, this is the recipe we make. That's how we make it. I go to other places and I make, this is why I don't say I like lakshan kugel, because I go other places and it's not the same.
Because it's not dairy.
It's not dairy, and it's too dry, and it's too, like, they overcompensate the sweet. And I actually had a really, really good peppery one.
Yeah.
Where they caramelized the sugar just right.
Like a Yerushalmi.
Beth, like, she, like, it was, well, it was
Beth,
amazing.
Come on,
and
she's
it was
good.
In like a, you know, like you do it in a cast iron, I think.
Yeah.
It was a whole, right? So when it's done right, it was good. I was skeptical because I've just had it done like, you're like, oh, this is like dried.
So if you had to choose between the Betty Crocker family lore one, which from the 1950s, or your potato kugel.
Definitely the noodle kugel. Like, that's a comfort food. Like, it's funny. I used to make it in college and I would be like, Mom, like, why does that have to bake so long? I bake it in like 20 minutes and it's fine. She goes, well, the eggs need to set. I'm like, there's eggs in it?
Whoops.
Is there egg in a kugel? Of course there is.
I do love lakshan. It is more of a comfort food. But my Auntie Bobby used to make this potato kugel, and it was so popular in her house. And she had 8 kids. Mm. So for her, she had to make a bonus one and leave it out on the counter as the pre-Shabbos kugel.
Oh, I was going to say, it's like a sacrifice.
It's the sacrificial kugel, because everyone smells it being cooked.
Yes.
And would come in the kitchen and go, Ma, oh my gosh, it smells so good. Can I have a bite? And she'd go, sure. But really, it was the sacrificial kugel.
Nice.
And the real kugel was in the oven cooking for Shabbos. So she'd already, like, she'd start this one earlier. And then she would put it back in the warming drawer. And then all day when I would go for Shabbos in college, I would go into the warming drawer and there was already cuts and corners taken out of it. And everyone has their favorite spot. And I love, for that reason, I love that potato kugel. Most potato kugels, though, for me, need to be eaten on top of a cup of my father's cholent.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Have you ever cooked it that way?
Never prepared it that way, no. Okay. Where I, like, where you cook it and it's raw when you put it into the cholent?
Mm-hmm.
And it cooks in the cholent as the top layer. How does it not seep down as it cooks?
No, it keeps distinct layers, but it does soak up a little bit.
Okay, so it comes almost, we've really gotten distracted. We spent like 7 minutes on kugel, but like this is why.
Very Jewish.
This is very Jewish. I'm trying to figure out like what we should go to next, because I'm holding in my lap the Outlander Kitchen Cookbook.
I haven't made anything from that, and I only read the first book, so I don't know. Oh, and this also, like, because this was, okay, so a Harry Potter cookbook.
Yeah.
Right? Like, when you're reading these things, you know, you picture the food, but it's not the same thing as when you see it in the movie or you see it on a TV show and you're like, oh, that looks so good.
Well, so she tries. So this is by Teresa Carl Sanders, and she had, and she even got Deanna Gabaldon, the author, to write the foreword. So you know it's authentic. And the, I have to read the dedication.
Yeah.
She wrote, to Howard, my Englishman, you look and sound a lot like Frank, but your heart and love is pure Jamie.
Oh.
I know we're not doing a Hanukkah present episode until later this month, but this would make a good Hanukkah present for the Outlander person in your life.
Oh, 100%.
This is a great gift.
Especially, like, here's the thing, people. If you buy someone a cookbook, it ups the chances of them making you something.
Yes.
Right? If I bought you a cocktail cookbook, like, the chances of you making me something delicious is now increased. It's an investment.
I made something from this.
Yeah.
And because my husband bought it for me. So you were right.
Beer battered corn fritters?
Oh, my God. No. But what was it? I got, I made the fried chicken.
Oh. Nice.
It was so good. My God, I'm feeling the vodka now. It was so good. Okay. This was sweet tea brined fried chicken.
What?
Because apparently it was the Irish and the Scottish that brought fried chicken.
Really?
To America.
Wow.
And
sweet
so they,
tea brined?
Sweet tea brined. So what they do is at the beginning of every recipe, they show you the quote from the book and what page it's on in order to see where this item
I
was made.
That.
And then she makes it. So this, for example, has a description of the meal that they eat on page 54 of A Breath, chapter 54, this is big books, of A Breath of Snow and Ashes at Flora McDonald's Barbecue. And it lists all the food, I know, neither did I. It lists all the food that they ate. And on the list is fried chicken. And I made this fried chicken, but yeah, you have to brine the chicken in like an orange pecan black tea.
Yum.
Mixed with like rosemary and bay leaves and kosher salt, peppercorns and sugar. This was the best fried chicken I've ever had in my life. And I made
so
it.
Cool.
I followed this recipe exactly. I did not divert from
That's
it at
amazing.
All. You are not permitted to divert from it. And it was, I mean, obviously I had to make my own part of buttermilk.
Right.
Rich.
Yeah. Soy milk with vinegar.
Soy milk and vinegar. Yeah. I mean, there's a million different ways to do that online. But other than that, so you can buy these cookbooks and feel like, especially the Outlander one, and feel like it is not like a fan fiction. It really is part of the book.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I think the Harry Potter one was pretty popular for a while.
Did you buy it?
I did not buy it. I think I know people that have had it, and the idea of the butterbeer sounds amazing.
It has a recipe for butterbeer?
Of course it does.
I thought I would just have to go to Disney World to get that.
No, there's a recipe for it.
What?
And it's kosher because a woman who wrote it is Jewish.
Wow.
One of the Harry Potter ones, at least. And so I don't know how she handles, like, straight up, this isn't a kosher thing, but... most of the things are kosherizable, at least.
You know, I like it when a Jewish author throws that in. Like Adina Sussman from Sababa. This particular cookbook is all kosher.
Yeah.
Like a lot of Tel Aviv-based cookbooks have shrimp in them.
Right.
And she didn't include it. She didn't include any shrimp.
That's great.
And there's no meat and milk mixed together. It's a huge improvement.
That one just came out, right?
It just came out. And she was great. I met Adina at her, she had like a meet and greet after, where they had prepared her... tahina blondies.
Whoa.
For everyone's taste.
Wow, that sounds good. Was it good?
Yes! I ate a lot. Tahina brown blondies.
I would never have thought, but I guess that makes sense.
They were like,
they were like halva at that point?
No. What's ringing?
That's your phone.
No, it's your phone.
It's my phone.
Haha! No. Isn't an alarm telling you
it's
to record?
Silent.
I think it's an alarm telling you it's time to record this podcast.
That's actually kind of hilarious.
Sorry, phone. Too late. So yeah, we're going to talk about this again in the Hanukkah gift thing, but since this is new, Sababa by Adina Sussman, but yes, the food in there is Israeli, but bright, colorful, lots of sweet.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me more about this list that you have of food.
I started writing books that have food in it, but I also brought cookbooks with me.
What'd you bring?
Kind of like
Let's go to yours.
Oh, so this is my favorite cookbook. So my friend, Mayim Panina. So my friend Mayim Panina is a great cook.
Okay.
And I mean, it's not really my story to tell, but she was a Mennonite who converted to Judaism.
Oh,
so
that's awesome.
She took me into like Mennonite areas and we would go shopping and... she would come and help. We would cook together for Yom Tov. I miss her so much.
Did you buy furniture?
No.
Oh, that's the good
stuff. There's nothing like having another person in the kitchen cooking with you. Mm-hmm. Like, you to feel like, I don't know, there's a camaraderie, there's a, like a nice feeling. And so I miss having her in the kitchen. But she bought me this
cookbook. You're a cook with another person?
I like it.
Oh.
So we would come up with menus together, and then we would cook for holidays together. She has farty influences. So she would make like...
Which is a former Mennonite with farty influences.
Yes.
Sold.
So her, like, she would make a haroset, but the Sephardi style one with dates and bananas and like, but interesting things in it. So this is called More with Less: Recipes and Suggestions by Mennonites and How to Eat Better and Consume Less of the World's Limited Resources.
You know, Jonathan Safran Foer, the author who I really love, he actually has a book out right now about eating less proteins.
Right.
And it includes stuff like this. Like, listen, I'm not saying give up meat. I'm saying give up protein for breakfast. Well, let's start with that.
This is like, don't make it the main part of the meal.
Yeah. Just
have it as like
enjoy
a taste.
Other things.
Exactly. This is called like make a lot of dishes and one of them has a taste of meat in it. Like don't make it whatever. And so
would happen if we did that on Shabbos?
There would be a revolution.
We should try it. Yeah. Don't warn the kids. I'll tell you,
I'm not using this cookbook because, I mean, I tend not to cook so much meat, just, you know, practicality. And also I just really like ice cream.
That's pretty.
What I like is that these are tried and true recipes.
Oh, so they're Mennonite recipes, right?
Yeah. So there are all these recipes and then there's like quotes from people like, I substitute almonds here, or I like serve this for breakfast and you warm it like this.
Oh.
And so it's got all these little comments. And so it tells you, this is from Akron, Pennsylvania, and it has all these different recipes and they are all things that you have in your pantry. You don't have to go shopping. So as I turn the pages of my More with Less cookbook, with the spots and stains and drips and smears tell me the value of a particular recipe. I feel the same way.
Yeah.
I call it the scratch and sniff cookbook. The pages are full of markings. Then the recipe is the good one. A tried and true favorite.
It's cute.
So Russian Mennonites must have these to accompany a watermelon feast. The salty version goes well with
soup. Wait, Russian Mennonites?
Uh-huh.
I didn't realize that was a thing.
Yeah. There's also
They have a recipe for fry bread. Navajo fry bread.
Yeah. So,
that's my favorite.
And so this is from Colorado and Indiana. And so there are also Mennonites in Mexico. So this is like a really international inspired cookbook. And so I really like it because I know that I will have all the ingredients in my pantry already and I can just make something. So I'll be like, oh, I just need a cake quick, or I just want like a soup that's good. So they're pretty home style. So like, this is like a creamy chicken casserole. Okay. So I'm not going to be able to make that, but I may be able to change up a few things. But because it's pretty basic, like the kosher is not a big problem. Look, I'm impressed with what the Zambians eat that the North Americans throw away, parts of the vegetable. So like, it also tells you like, how do you use these parts of the vegetable? And like, some of the recipes build on each other. First you make this one. And then if you make this one, then now you can make these three other things and they go together, or those are
changes. I like that. It's not wasteful.
Yeah, exactly.
See, I'm a big fan of like not being wasteful. Even when I see things that have expiration dates and I'm like, oh, I feel sad. Like, I feel sad. So this is really, it's a nice thing to have something like this.
So it says pumpkin can be stored 6 months or longer. So this could be an economical dish and it tells you different ways to make
pumpkin. That's a good point. So, I didn't know that about pumpkin.
Yeah. So anyway, this is, it's no processed food really. Like one of my biggest pet peeves is when a recipe includes a processed good in it. Like, I'm sorry, if I needed a recipe for soup and you're telling me to start with a can or carton of soup.
Yes.
And I would just use that can or carton.
When they sell me start with vegetable stock and I'm like, well, that's silly. Why would I buy a box of vegetable stock? It's not that hard to make it.
Right.
And I'm thinking, not only that, what if it's a vegetable stock with a flavor that I don't like, which exactly. I often find.
I know. So even the chicken stock sometimes, my kids don't like it.
Yeah.
Or like cake recipes that include a box cake mix that you've now doctored up. I'm like, there's a time and a place, but right now I just want a real recipe.
I didn't open this cookbook so you could tell me to make pumpkin dump cake.
Yeah, thank you.
I know how to make that. That's easy. I can add two ingredients, I'm done. I'm talking about like opening up a cookbook and saying, wow, that's so interesting. Okay, so this is a good one.
Oh.
Rena Rosner.
Okay.
Rena Rosner, who's the author of the Sisters of the Winter
Wood. Oh, I kind of recognize the name.
So great. She wrote a cookbook called Eating the Bible, which is 50 delicious recipes. It's not every parsha, as you can see from the number, right? 50 delicious recipes to feed your body and nourish your soul. And so usually when you see like eating the Bible style stuff online, like parsha, Kalakrums, and those websites, they're usually cutesy, right? Like how to make rainbow fruit roll-ups
for Parsha's. Kala shaped like a camel.
Right. Most of Rena's recipes are beautiful recipes. And most of her recipes involve like getting real with really good food.
Ooh, exactly. That's so pretty. It's just a stack of vegetables. Pepper, eggplant, and zucchinis stacked beautifully. I'm allergic, but still.
Yeah, if it's stacked beautifully. It's called a Bavel Vegetable Towers.
Oh, that's cute. So
you're serving like a beautiful appetizer, and it's not cutesy. It's stunning.
Yeah.
But then people say, wow, you can say to people like, these are my Bavel Towers, which I think is great. But then she also has recipes for making what she calls dust, which is her earthly seasonings. And so this is one of those things. My favorite, though, is that she has a recipe that uses tons and tons and tons of salt, where you take the potatoes and you basically bury them in thick kosher salt. And it's really, really good. I mean, obviously anything covered in salt is going to be delicious. But yeah, so she actually, her recipes are more creative and more inventive and pretty. And even like wagon wheel pasta salad. And
lots I like that one. Hold on. It shows you how to roll the chicken. That's always like, there was like, and then the chickens rolled beautifully. And you're like, what? Wait.
But how? Right. There's a photo array of once you stuff the chicken breast that's been flattened and, you know, smushed down, how to roll it up and to get it into the pan so it stays rolled.
I've done that basically, by the way, where you put deli inside.
Yes,
and then
me
you
too.
Roll it. It's so yummy. It and then I actually breaded it with ground up almonds.
Oh my gosh, look. Pistachio almond chicken parcels.
Okay, see.
So that's what we're talking about here. So this is a really good one. It also includes information about the parsha. And she introduces each one with parsha facts and parsha information and quotes from the Torah.
I have a couple friends that buy cookbooks to read them and don't actually cook out of them.
It's kind of
me. So it's nice to have them. You know, it's funny because I don't buy well-written ones.
Yeah.
I go for practicality. Like, oh, this one's going to teach me Asian-style cooking or Indian-style cooking. Well,
do you have a Persian one? Like, isn't that one of those?
Oh, this one's beautiful.
It's just about Persian cooking.
I won this one.
And you won it? Everyone likes to win stuff.
No, there was a time when I was winning a lot of stuff on the internet. But so this is Reina Sinagar's family. So she dates back. Her family is from the Spanish Inquisition. And she married into a Persian family. And so this is her learning to cook from her in-laws. And her sister-in-law.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
And so what I like is that she tells you about when it's appropriate. Because some recipes are like seasonal, right? This is, we make it at this time of year. And so she talks about like how you know it's kosher. The spices she's using, she tells you.
Oh, this is a good list.
The description, the kosher status, and like where you could find it. Do you need to find it online? Do you need to go to a specialty market?
Yeah.
Or could you go to a regular market and it's called some other name? So I like that also.
That's good too.
And then she gives you like a list. These are the kinds of vegetables and fruits that I'm going to be using and legumes and nuts. And so you can get like a shopping list going and think like, oh, and here's all the, like you need a tea kettle and a samovar, you need kebab skewers. So you can kind of go through and see like, oh, okay, if I wanted to have a Persian cookout, like here's some things I'd have to get started
be prepared.
Yeah. And I really like it. And the pictures are gorgeous.
This is pretty. See, food photography. I know my sister Melinda spent a lot of time learning food photography because there's so many tricks and tools to getting it to look this pretty.
Oh, I know. So it's funny. A friend of mine blogs under, the name Penny, Penniless Parenting. And so she does a lot of food, like foraging, and then she makes things out of it. And she's like,
that's my thing.
The thing is that sometimes food tastes amazing and does not look pretty.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's hard to like this, what is on this side? This is some kind of dip. It just kind of like, it's artistically taken, but it might just look like bleh.
Right. If we were to see this bowl of dip from above, we'd be like, that's a bowl of dip. Like, yeah, it's right, not exactly. Interesting. But the way that she shot it made it look interesting.
Yes, they formed it and they added some garnish.
Yes.
And they blurred it artistically through a glass dish. And
yes.
Whatever.
A lot of these Persian foods would not look pretty necessarily if you saw them, but you'd be so tempted by the smells and flavors, you probably just wouldn't care.
And so to be honest, I don't follow recipes.
This looks good.
I am not.
Oh, she's a latke. You open to the latke page.
She has latkes.
Oh my gosh.
They're called Levivot.
Oh yeah. Persian latkes are called Levivot.
So
that's nice. I like
and
that.
And it has like she tells you what's the difference and like how's it a little different. What do you need? What tools are required? So what I like to do, I'm not a good rule follower. I don't follow recipes well. But what I want to do is why I have these recipe books is that I look and I want to know what flavors to put together.
That's the thing for me is when I look at a cookbook, I do the same thing.
Yeah.
Is that's why these food cookbooks based on novels are never exact. Like you're not going to have the exact recipe from the book. The recipe's not in the book.
Right.
But you want to get the cultural and historical location to go with the recipe.
Unless you're reading the Cupcake Mysteries, because they legit put recipes in.
Oh, no. Like, the All Saints book also has, like, legit. We're going to talk a little bit more about this after a quick break. So you had the Persian cookbook.
Yes.
I have in front of me a gift from my friend Lily. Ooh. Please to the table, the Russian cookbook. Nice. But what's funny about this cookbook, it says 400 glorious recipes from the Baltics to Uzbekistan. What's funny about this cookbook, please to the table, which I love that it's phrased kind of the way that it would be translated, right? Like everyone please to the table, is that a lot of it is Soviet because I believe this is published during, it was published 1990. In 1990.
Yeah.
So a lot of food was not there and a lot of food was not available yet. Mm-hmm. And so it's pretty much like Soviet ingredient cookbook. Like there's a lot of mayonnaise and sour cream and the same ingredients used over and over and over again because they were the kinds of things you get in bulk.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Right.
Yeah.
That's how I shop too.
But this one, it literally gives you little facts about the different areas. But also it gives you kind of information about certain things, like a Ukrainian proverb, borscht, the center of everything. And then it's a whole section about what borscht is. And then the fact why Russians start with soup because of Peter the Great. And like, it really gives you a lot of fun, but they're done in a fun way. Like they're really clever. Oh. And so even if you're like, I don't understand, I'm supposed to make jellied veal. That's disgusting. I would never make jellied veal. Right. But do you have jellied veal?
No, definitely. I don't jelly things.
I don't eat an aspic. I'm not an aspic person, right? No. Jellied meats, jellied fishes, pass. But this is a very popular thing, at least at the time. So
you can look at like what vegetables they're using, what the flavor profile is. Okay, it's dill and bay and parsley. So if you're going to cook veal, that might be a good flavor profile.
Exactly.
That's where I'm getting inspiration from.
Exactly. So you're getting inspiration from it. And obviously the soups are all going to be delicious. Everyone wants tomato cilantro soup. Like they're all going to be really good. But I love a book that just focuses on one part of the world.
Yeah.
And then tells you, like breaks it down. Like this is what's available in this region of the world. This is what's available in this region of the world. But also like what's available in Russia, a lot of it's available here. It's not like Middle Eastern cooking where you're like, I can't get the right garbanzo beans.
Oh,
and you can't.
You
cannot get the right garbanzo beans here.
You can't market?
Not the same. They're from Mexico.
Really?
Yes. That's one of the things that Dean Assessment told us, is that unless you're getting Middle Eastern specific chickpeas, that you're not really getting the hummus chickpeas, which is why the hummus that's made here that you make at home is grainier.
Because it is grainier.
It is grainier. She said because the skins.
I thought I was too lazy to peel them.
Yeah, no, it's because the skins from the Israeli chickpeas like fall off basically.
Uh-huh.
And the ones from Mexico kind of dissolve into the mixture
yeah,
and they stay grainy and gross. So yeah, it's all about knowing where your food comes from.
Yeah.
What else did you bring?
I have with me the Moosewood cookbook. So again, this is another Mayan Panina recommendation. So it's funny because she used to talk about this reverently. She had this cookbook.
You said this was like a famous cookbook and yours certainly looks worn out.
So what's funny is I saw it at a consignment shop and I was like, oh my gosh, the Moosewood cookbook at a consignment shop for $1. And so I grabbed it, and it definitely looks like the person before me either loved it or hated it. Because it's like completely...
Looks like it got caught in a storm.
It got wet, but...
And the font is the handwriting font.
Yeah, it's cute.
It is cute.
It's, you know, and again, these are tried and true recipes. It's pretty... It's also heavily vegetarian, you know, gazpacho, and they're pretty singular ingredient. Not singular ingredient, but like streamlined. Not a lot of extra stuff. Not a lot of processed foods included in it. You know, you're not going to be told to start with vegetable stock unless it says, go to page 30, make that vegetable stock, then come back to this page and continue the recipe.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of recipe book this is. And I like these ones. So here's the thing I find is that, you know, it's all well and good to say we have all these cookbooks. The problem is that they're not meant for Shabbos. They can't sit on a plaza hot plate.
That's right.
Friday night. They can't sit in a crock pot overnight. So I had a hard time with that. I started looking for crock pot recipes specifically because the flavor profile is meant to be cooked to death.
Yes.
So, and I found a few. So there's Crockpot 365 is a blog that I used to read. Now but she has a book.
Do they take into account winter crockpot times? The fact that we're like, we had guests over the Shabbat and she dropped off her crockpot and in it was a kale chicken sausage soup.
Ooh,
ready to be ready good. To go. And I was worried because she's like, don't worry, this is meant for this time of year. Like it can sit there for hours, like 18 hours, and it'll taste delicious. And she was right. It wasn't chillin'. Oftentimes, whatever you put in a crock pot becomes chillin'.
It gets more bitter. Yeah. Right. So I have a few recipes that are work. So Crockpot 365, she ended up publishing a book called Make It Fast, Cook It Slow.
Oh, I like that.
So, and what really got me is that her family has like a laundry list of allergies and like this and that. So her recipes are really easy to modify because like they don't have dairy in it, or they have this, so they don't have that, or she gives you other substitutions. So there's a couple that I've tried that are really good. I find that not everything will survive the crock pot, right? Even chili, you have to do certain things to it because it just gets bitter or it gets dried out. You have to plan ahead. So I always find that these recipes don't account for that. Someone told me they made fried chicken and then they served it for lunch and it was all white and puffy. And
I'm like, of course it was, yeah, because it's fried chicken. You can't reheat that.
Exactly. So not everyone knows that. And I think people, you know, the recipe, it doesn't tell you, hey, you know, if you're not eating this the moment you cook it, here's what you need to do.
Yeah.
So there's tricks. Like sometimes if you put a paper towel in, it'll soak up any extra moisture. So, or you open it so that it's not tightly closed when you're warming it, or, you know, you need to add slightly more sugar or some kind of molasses when you're leaving on the crock pot too long, or you need to make sure your water to grain ratio is this because it's going to be 18 hours.
Cause we always get it wrong.
Right.
Too liquidy or not liquidy enough. Right. And then I had one Shabbat where I looked at my chalent and there was no moisture. Could not figure out what was wrong.
No.
It cracked.
Oh, no.
And all the water had gone through the crack and had dissolved the minute it hit the outside of the crock pot. So what I was left with was just like a chunk of
a horror story.
It's a horror story. That's so a Shabbat horror story. I had other food.
So I'll tell you that chalent sometimes can make me nervous because you're like, I'm hoping this works out because if it doesn't, we're, you know, but it's also, I mean, it's a testament of faith.
Yeah.
But it's also, it is somewhat forgiving.
Yes.
Because it mingles and it just cooks for that long. There is something about smelling it all day. Like, does it make you want to eat it more or less? Sometimes I'm like, oh, I've smelled this all day.
I think I like it when I put it up before Shabbat, we go out for dinner, and we come home Friday night.
Oh, and then my gosh.
That's when I like it.
It smells the best then.
Yes, that's the best moment. Then when at midnight or 2 in the morning, I have to smell. Then I'm like,
I put a lot of cumin in mine. So,
oh, you do?
Yeah, so it smells
I actually really good. Don't usually season it. I usually just put a kishka on top.
Okay, that's not seasoning either.
Because kishkas are usually seasoned. A lot of them are really seasoned.
Not as much as I season my chalent. I put green chilies and cumin and garlic and
all that. I mean, I love my dad's chalent with the sriracha in it.
Oh, yeah.
And he just puts barley. That's his only grain.
So I have a couple cookbooks. Like I said, Indian cooking, Asian cooking. And I say Asian, it says on the book, real big Asian.
Yeah.
and it tells you where it's from. Like, this is Vietnamese and this is that. So there's one recipe I have for curry chicken that I make for lunch. You put a whole chicken in the crock pot and then you add coconut milk, curry, cilantro, some vegetables, and then cover it with water.
It doesn't turn into chilling?
It doesn't. It turns into like a super thick chicken stew that tastes, because it's got the cilantro and the curry in it, like yellow curry. You know, it has like a completely different taste than our traditional chicken soup. But it lasts in the crock pot all day, and it's somewhat different. So I like
– It's not – I mean, I also like making hamin with the safari chalent. I do like making hamin. Yep. I like that everything goes in its own individual, like, bag, like a cheesecloth, which is not really for cheese. It's for cheese. It's not made of cheese. And you put everything individually, and then it separates. So you really have – we were at a friend's house. She's like, I didn't make much. I just made hamin. And I'm like, yeah. And then I looked in her kitchen. She had three crock pots going.
Oh, yeah.
And, like – 15 dishes came out because all her hameen was like split up between three different crock pots yes. and everything came out. I was like, here's the eggs and here's the dumplings and here's the, you know, separate the kibbeh and the separate beans yeah, and these, yeah. and the garbanzo beans are over here and the barley's over here and this one. And over here we have the chillant rice, you know, like I was like, oh my God. And then this one has the meats and I'm like, this is amazing. Oh, it's all you made for lunch. I used to do that the first year of our marriage when we were both working a lot of hours. We would just put up a chillant.
Yeah.
And we would trust it. And I would have a chicken one
yeah.
and a meat one. And that was it.
Yeah.
You just have to kind of, that's the thing with Shabbat is you have to have faith.
Gotta have faith.
So if you're looking for recipes, here's what was funny. I bought this at Costco.
Okay.
This is called A Year Full of Recipes.
Okay.
Supposedly the idea is you just start on day one.
Okay.
And there's 365 recipes.
Okay.
And on day one, you start. And that's it. And you could go January, and from there, you just go, which is very convenient. Oh,
that's actually a nice idea. Because you know what? I do feel like I get into a rut.
Yes.
Where I'm making the same thing all the time, and I want to make something different.
So if you were to open this up and go, well, I don't have to do ham, I could do turkey. Fine. Day one, bake ham.
Boneless chicken thighs is a replacement for. So it's funny because I used to do meal planning. Idea.
Yeah.
And the meal planning, she would tell you all the substitutes make it kosher or vegetarian.
I like that. So I like the idea.
Boneless chicken thighs is a good replacement for ham.
Wait, but here's the funny.
Not
okay,
ham,
so
but pork.
We're on day five and we've had some great meals. Barley, lentil, onion soup, sesame beef, a hearty beef stew. We've had a lot of proteins. This is a bit expensive. Okay, fine. We're in penne with cheese, baked tuna and ricotta, spaghetti carbonara.
3 days in a row?
Yeah, it's going okay. Except on January 10th when dinner is hot banana butterscotch.
What?
I knew I had to show this to you. This is the weirdest cookbook because I would say 90% of it is great. And then you're like, my kids are supposed to eat a slaw for dinner?
No, you can't eat slaw
just
for dinner.
Just slaw? And then on the 10th, it's just butterscotch pudding. And then you're like, the next night, rib roast. Okay, we're back to normal. Everything's going okay. We've got a few nights where we're on like a real thing. And then everything's going all right. It goes on. And then on the 19th, Paris with caramel. And on the 20th, dessert again.
It's like, you know, there wasn't any dessert in this menu, so or in this cookbook, so we have to throw some dessert in, but then
what? So
are you eating leftovers?
Is this assuming that you'll have had food left over from the chicken pot pie the day before?
Maybe.
Like, maybe this is one of those things where it's like, we know that this is too much chicken pot pie, and that you just had rib roast.
You're going to have dessert for 2 days.
2 days of desserts.
You won't need to cook anything else because you have leftovers. I'm not, to be honest, I'm not sure.
All of a sudden, ground beef mashed potatoes. I'm like, oh, that's brilliant. My kids will eat that.
They actually group them too much, though. So I don't know. I didn't. Yes. Would I make two casseroles in a row?
No, I would not. I would not make a chicken casserole
pasta in a row?
Followed by a fish casserole and then a potato. Like,
ooh,
everything in it looks good. So
maple cream tarts, churros. Oh my God. I
2 days
churros
in a row. But 2 days in a row. First of all, if I was living here alone, I would just do this cookbook.
Right.
I'd be like, tonight is churro night for dinner. I don't make the rules.
It says
in the Year Full of Recipes cookbook.
That tonight is churros.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you,
you
but
you can
it's...
get frozen churros at Cash and Carry, by the way.
Those are good. But then you're like going through it.
Hot
and
chocolate.
Why would I? 5 days in a row of desserts. The 27th of January, you were supposed to have hot chocolate for dinner.
No, that doesn't make sense. Who wrote this cookbook?
I don't even know what's happening.
You might die, which is why I thought Crock-Pot 365, like all of her recipes were normal. She did have a couple dessert ones.
Yeah. Oh, this is good looking though.
Yeah.
Gnocchi with turkey and broccoli. I mean, yum. And turkey scallops with prosciutto. And everything is delicious. Everything looks good. But I'm cracking up because I'm like four nights in a row of dessert. Yeah. Why am I eating macarons?
For dinner. Hey, I don't make the rules.
Yeah.
We have a concern that your children are not eating nutritious, you know, meals.
I'll send back a photo of the cover of the cookbook. I'm doing the book.
They said that one day they had churros and the next night they had chocolate and then they went to bed.
Yeah, right. Any teacher would be like, can I live with you?
Right, exactly.
If I heard my student wasn't eating dinner, I'd be concerned. But if I heard my student was living in a house where they were like having dessert for dinner, I'd be like, fun house.
So funny story. I have my children are mouthy because I'm mouthy and I created them. So
yeah,
my daughter had a serious argument with her teacher when she was like 5 years old that pizza was a health food.
Yeah.
Because her mom makes it from scratch.
Aww.
And if her mom makes it from scratch, her mom only makes healthy food. Because I really do cook healthy food.
And first of all, I know the way you cook. I bet your pizza really was healthier than other people's
pizza.
It was
like whole grain.
Spelt flour.
And it had like vegetables on it. And to her mind.
My sister shreds tofu with her mozzarella.
Right.
Kids have no idea. Well, now they like it. But at the time, they didn't know.
So it's, we can't eat fast food.
Yeah.
Right? My kids have never had fast food. They don't really understand that pizza's considered fast food, not a healthy thing.
Well, what happened? What did the teacher say? Yeah.
I don't think any side won in that argument. It's just.
My daughter wrote her essay. She's in fourth grade. They had to learn how to write essays, like persuasive arguments about their opinions. And it was really cute. And I got to look at it tonight at the school's open house.
Oh, nice.
So sweet. It was the most charming open house. They had all the lights out and everything was decorated with little like white Christmas lights. Mm. And everyone was given a flashlight. And then they walked around and then each kid pointed the flashlight their project to illuminate learning. It's a very clever theme.
I'm rolling my eyes a little bit, but cute.
Illuminate learning. I walked in. I'm like, okay, I get what's happening now. But at first I was like, oh, it's if you're going to go at night, the kids had a much more charming time because it was dark.
And everyone loves a flashlight.
Everyone loves a flashlight, and the kids got their flashlights. So I go look at her essay. It's a persuasive essay on why you should eat your vegetables.
Okay.
And I looked at her, and I'm like, but you don't eat any vegetables. And she goes, well, I don't have to believe it. I just have to persuade you. And I'm like, persuade everyone else? She's like, yeah, for sure. But I don't have to like vegetables just to know what the arguments are. I'm like, oh.
It's very clever, to be honest.
Oh, and she wrote in there, and for parents who cannot get their kids to eat vegetables, you can always hide it in their food.
Yes.
And I have that cookbook, Deceptively Delicious.
Oh, yes.
Jessica Seinfeld.
Okay, so there's two of them that came out at the same time.
Yeah.
There's another one, like The Sneaky Chef or something like that.
Similar.
And so, I was doing that for a while where I was shredding vegetables. If you shred certain vegetables, when you cook it with ground beef, it almost disappears.
Yes, for sure. Zucchini's one of those where if you chop it up real small and you use marinara sauce.
So I was doing that for a long time. In fact, oh my gosh, I had a friend visiting from out of town. She came in from Israel and she's like, can I just stay with you one night and whatever? I was like, of course you can. I'm making dinner. I'm making macaroni and cheese, but let me just tell you how I make macaroni and cheese. I add vegetables and tuna. And she's like, so she doesn't say anything, and then she gets in. She's like, I thought you were joking. I'm like, no, I need my kids to eat protein and vegetables. So I throw it in the macaroni and cheese. So really, it's more like a creamy tuna casserole.
I love tuna casserole.
Right? So, yeah. But that's how my kids, I had to get them to eat protein and vegetables. I had to.
Yes.
So in the macaroni and cheese it goes. Like, that's the vehicle.
Oh, my parents used to buy those skewer steaks. Remember those? When you were a kid, it was popular in the 80s. It was like the sliced very edge of the meat, and they roll it in a circle, and then they put a skewer through it.
Yeah.
So basically, it's a pinwheel of meat.
Yes.
The problem is, I like my meat pink, and skewer steaks are always dark.
Yeah.
So I just have these terrible memories of, as a kid, of my parents going like, eat it! And I'm like, I don't want to eat it. Like, I just felt like such a spoiled brat because I was like, just make me a steak. Like, you don't have to convince me to eat meat by rolling it into a circle and making it pretty like a lollipop. I'll eat it. Just put it on my plate like a steak, you know? So sometimes I think I'm convincing my kids by hiding it, but really, if I just make my kid a tuna sandwich, he's going to eat the tuna.
Right, exactly.
It's one of those things we're convinced when our kids are real little.
Well, so my kids don't eat mushrooms unless I cooked it with meat so that they all taste like meat.
Oh, yeah. Mushrooms hide beautifully.
Yeah.
Mushrooms hide really well in soups.
Although I used the can of mushroom soup once to make a cheat fettuccine Alfredo because I usually make a roux.
I never use that for it. That's clever.
Oh. So I usually make it from scratch. I use the Pioneer Woman.
Oh yeah.
So her macaroni and cheese recipe is the bomb.
Is it just butter?
It does start with butter, but I use margarine and it's fine. But yeah. So I was using a cheater method where I use the cream of mushroom soup mix to make it. Mm. And, so I serve it and my kids are looking like, this isn't your usual one. And they're spoiled. They don't even like box macaroni and cheese. I had to convince them to like it.
Because
I make it from scratch.
I have the opposite problem.
Right? So they're eating it and my son goes, what is this? And I'm like, what? He goes,
the tiny little mushroom?
There's a speck of a mushroom on the end of his fork. And he's like, is there a mushroom in this? I'm like, Are you the princess and the pea? Because honestly, it's not even a mushroom anymore. It's like microscopic.
That's not a mushroom.
It's buttled.
That's from the cheese. It's aged cheese.
Right.
It's better this way.
It's a crumb from a noodle.
Oh my God. My kids eat so many noodles and cheese.
Yeah.
They ate so much noodles and cheese, and it made me feel like such a bad mom. But they, like, I now that they're older, I can't stop them because I'll make dinner, the late dinner, and a few hours later, I find my oldest making pasta.
Yeah.
And then pouring it out. He rings the bell. We have a dinner bell
that
we bought in New Orleans. We love this dinner bell because you can hear it over the Xbox. And I hear him ringing the dinner bell for his siblings, like, noodles up.
Noodles.
I'm like,
So I bought the noodles that are made with vegetables.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how much vegetables like actually in there.
No.
They have one.
They say they're made with the flour from the vegetable. Yeah. That's the first ingredient on the lentil ones is lentil flour. But have you tasted them?
Some of them are okay. Mm. Some of them, I got chickpea ones. I've tried whole wheat ones. You know, I try different ones. It depends what you're putting it in. I find that they can hold up. They're good in soup because they are. They get less squishy.
That's good in soup. I think we could do a lentil pasta and lentil soup for the parsha.
Yes. it's funny. I used to buy these instant noodles that tasted and had the taste and texture of elementary school paper towels.
The way that Wacky Mac tastes like Play-Doh?
Yes.
Okay. So what you're saying.
So, but the broth was always so good.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I still eat the Wacky Mac. I don't care if it tastes like Play-Doh.
Right.
Because it's like having candy. Strawberry candies don't taste like strawberries.
They do not.
Wacky Mac doesn't taste like cheese, even when I add cheese to it. So I see what you're saying. Like, you just kind of, some things are just comfort foods, you know.
Oh, instant mashed potatoes.
Instant mashed potatoes is a wonderful comfort. And the one you buy at Costco in the individual packages, and you just put them in the microwave.
No,
they're butter, they're dairy. And for the kids, it's like, that's a comfort food.
That's it.
I think so. This all does tell us one thing about middle grade, which we haven't gotten to yet.
Yeah.
The food in middle grade books is treated kind of the way it's treated in the movie Hook, where, you know, kids are eating all of these beautiful cupcakes and large turkey legs and everything is oversized and glamorous and it ends with a food fight. But the truth is, everything ends with a food fight in a middle grade book, right? Like cafeteria food fights, lots and lots of food fights.
I wrote down Roald Dahl on my list.
Yes!
Because, you know, that's...
It's a good example. In middle grade food is always treated like fantasy. When the truth is in reality that 12-year-olds... yes, 12-year-olds are really picky.
They're eating a pudding cup.
Yes.
And a cheese stick.
Yes.
And calling it a day.
Yes. And maybe they'll grab like a tradition soup in their lunch.
Right.
Right. Like when you're writing for 12-year-olds, keep in mind that they don't have fantasy meals in their real life.
No, they
and
don't.
If they were faced with one, they wouldn't want to eat it.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine getting hit with a pudding cup? It's not going to be a good time.
No. No. It would end poorly.
Yeah.
It's like they have very specific tastes. They want tater tots and they want French fries. Give them tater tots.
So one of my comfort foods is quesadillas. So I'll make quesadillas
a
lot. It's yummy and so I'll...
Microwave or pan?
In a pan.
You make them for real or do you like microwave quesadillas?
No, I usually put them in the oven actually.
You spend time.
Yeah. So,
all right.
So sometimes I put refried beans on them. And so I had made a whole bunch more than my eyes, you know, more than my stomach, my eyes.
Your eyes are bigger than your stomach.
So
yeah.
My daughter packed a few for lunch, except that I'd already added hot sauce. And this will be fine for my daughter, except that she and her best friend split their lunches together. Like they split everything and they eat like... You know, she's like, I need an even number of chicken nuggets because she's going to get half and I'm going to.
Oh, they're so cute.
And that poor girl, she's real tall and blonde and very cute.
Yeah.
Cannot handle the hot sauce, apparently.
Oh, no.
My daughter was like, I didn't realize you put so much hot sauce until I turned over and she was bright red and her hair was on fire. You know, my daughter was like, oh, that's right. We put hot sauce in our quesadillas.
Did you have a friend at school that brought food that you wanted and you would trade because you brought food she wanted?
Sometimes.
I was the only Ashkenazi girl in my class for a number of years.
Yeah.
And my Sephardic friends always had burekas.
Oh,
and one of my friends always had balemas. And I was always like, I'm going to sit over here at the Sephardic table. I know I brought a salami sandwich. You eat at the meat table and we'll switch lunches and I'll come over and sit at the dairy table. I'll bench with a Sephardim. I don't care. I learned Sephardic benching real fast as a kid because I was the only Ashkenazi. And when we're talking Sephardic for our East Coast listeners, we're talking Greek and Turkish. It's Ladino speaker Sephardim. So we're talking Mediterranean dairy food. Balemas are cheese in them. They have potatoes. alternative spinach, like depending on the balama. Like we're talking Rhodes. If you go to the Rhodes Jewish Museum website, /food, if you do /food after the website, you'll find a secret cache of recipes that if it's not in the index, you have to know to do /food. And then all of a sudden, and they're all from Seattle people who won't share their recipes with me. And I'm like, can I have Auntie Ray's recipe for blah, blah, blah? And they're like, no, Auntie Ray only shared it with her nieces and nephews. And I'm like, that's okay. I have it now. It's for the Rhodes website.
Your biscocho is mine.
And they'll teach you, but they want to show you so you get it right, which I understand.
Yes.
I totally understand that. I'm going to learn to make challah.
Oh, nice.
Do you make challah?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I have a good recipe with oatmeal.
Do you do the tefillos when you put in each ingredient now, or do you just
I'm not
do
anointing
the one?
My family. I'm sorry.
Anointing you. I did it recently. It came out poorly.
Okay.
But I did do the tefillos that my cousin Shani Targan had done an event in Israel, like at a great big challah bake. And she'd written on Busy in Brooklyn's printouts for her recipe a different little mini tefillah that they came up with.
Oh, that's nice.
For each ingredient. And I screenshotted it. So I was like, I want these.
That's cute.
It made it special. Like I teared up a little.
Oh, that's nice.
It did, because I read them in English, so I could really embrace them.
Really, you're thinking about it.
And it was stuff like, you know, may this fill up my children and give them sustenance.
Oh, that's nice.
And may I have happiness for Shabbat and peace and rest. And like, it was really.
Yeah.
So there's something about we as Jews, there's specialness to your food. When I'm reading a Jewish book, I want the food to feel special.
Yeah, I do. I also like reading other cultures and seeing what they're eating.
Yeah.
Like, what do you have in your lunch? And, you know, what are you eating for breakfast? Oh my gosh, have you ever seen that photo display of like all the different breakfasts?
Yes. It's like when you're in breakfast in Israel and you're like, salad for breakfast.
Okay. Do you know what the American breakfast is at the cafes there in Israel?
What?
It's a brownie. It's a brownie and a coffee.
That actually reads. That
a
reads.
Brownie? Because you don't need brownies for breakfast.
Americans,
they're like donuts, brownies, whatever. They're eating junk.
Well, no, but if you go to Aroma, you can buy a chocolate croissant for breakfast. That's
what
Americans do.
There's a difference between a chocolate croissant and a brownie.
Is there? Is there really?
To us, I mean,
you can taste more butter in the croissant, but that doesn't make it any less, you know.
Okay, fine. I understand why they're like, whatever.
Or Tel Adavar, same thing.
They're eating pastries.
I miss Aroma. Oh my goodness. So I'm saying that like breakfast and other, I want to read a book where I read about the food in other countries. And, you know, when I read Inside Out and Back Again, and it was about a Vietnamese girl, and even it was a book in verse, middle grade book in verse, and I read it with my students. It was so interesting to see the way that she makes lists of food that she purchases. Yeah. And as their family started having to save more money because of the war in Vietnam, that her lists got changed and they got shorter.
Yeah.
And the way she writes about like eating sticky sesame candies and the black sesame in her mouth. Like it was, I got it because it was, again, we've discussed this. If you get specific with your culture, and I actually feel it more.
Yes, definitely. The number one ladies detective agency.
Yeah.
You know, what she talks about, you know, about the things that she's buying and the food that she's eating and the smells in the kitchen. And, you know, it makes it feel more like I'm there, and rather than like, oh, because I feel there's other times when I'm reading the book and I'm like, oh, this person was Asian. I didn't realize. Like, I just like imagined it was me in the book.
Yeah.
So when they give me more details, then I feel like I'm peering in someone's window. I'm not like, you know, genericizing them. You've made them more real.
Yeah.
And less interchangeable.
Yes. And you have to, if you do it in a way that honors a person instead of stereotypes a person, then it definitely has more meaning to it. And I can feel it. Like, I'm like, oh, and not that I don't like to be surprised. It would be fun if I was surprised. Like, oh, I didn't realize that person was Asian. I'm like, that's funny and surprising. Yeah. Like, oh, that's a Jewish character this whole time. And
this
I didn't know.
Time?
Like, oh, surprise me.
In 8 Kisses. The Hanukkah and
Don't spoil it. I'm only halfway through.
Okay, I'm not going to spoiler it, but one of my favorite stories takes place in a bakery.
Yeah.
And it's a naughty bakery. And I'm just going to leave that there.
I'm not at the naughty bakery yet. We're going to talk a little bit more after a quick musical interlude, where we're going to talk a little bit about our upcoming episodes, including 8 Kisses. Okay? All right. Cue some music.
Hashem, Hagdula, Nehagetura, Nehagetura, Nehagetura.
We're back. So somebody had tweeted that they don't know why in fantasy novels, the people are always taking with them bread and cheese on the journey.
Yeah.
And all these people are coming up with really ridiculous answers. And I was like, okay, practical answer as a writer. My brain says to me, what travels well?
What travels well? What won't go bad?
Hard cheese, hard bread.
Make you sick on the road.
Right. Hard cheese and hard bread travel well.
We're talking real hard, by the way.
Yes.
Not squished. Not like a squished cheese sandwich in your lunch.
No. In a fantasy novel, oftentimes their bags are made of canvas or leather or whatever. They're a sack. Right? And you have to throw things in. There's no pockets.
No pockets.
There's no pockets. There's no like little inside flaps inside the bag. It's a bag. Everything gets shoved into the same elbow sack.
Yes, exactly. And your extra cloak.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing you're hiding from the wizard.
Yes.
And whatever.
Yes. Yes. Everything's in the bag. Picture. And then picture, you know, Jamie and Claire washing their hands in the freezing cold river and then reaching into the bag for something. What are they reaching into the bag for? It's going to be something easy that's always good.
Right. Exactly. You can break it off. You don't need to necessarily cook it or, you know.
You don't need to prepare it. You don't need to get the poison out. Yeah. You don't need to wonder whether or not this mushroom is this or this mushroom. Like in Hunger Games with the berries, and she slaps the berries out of his hand.
Yes.
Because she's like, those are poisonous, Peeta. What are you doing?
Don't eat poison.
Don't eat.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So probably don't eat poison.
Don't eat poison berries. So the rule is you can't eat random things you find out there because some of them aren't what you think.
And from what my experience is from reading, because I don't know, is that it's harder to just like randomly kill something and eat it than you think it would be.
Yeah.
If you're not used to doing it, and then you're just like in the woods without equipment.
Not only that, animals hide from us. When Ari and I went to Texas, and we went to a like a game farm tour, right? Like one of those vast expanses, acreage and acreage and acreage of wildlife that happens to be fenced in at the very edges. And the people who run these, you know, game farms are, they don't even know where everything is. So they get out in their big truck. And this truck, you're standing on the back of a truck. Like literally, you're standing on a flatbed holding on to something for your dear life with binoculars in your hands. And you're around there. And it takes a while to find animals. Right. And first of all, it was unbelievable. One of the best experiences ever. But we looked a long time for feral hogs and we did not find any.
30 to 50?
We found, 30 to 50 feral hogs. Does anyone have 30 to 50 feral hogs? If you don't get that, go on Twitter and search for feral hogs, which apparently killed a woman outside her home.
30
to 50 of them. 30 to 50 of them. Sorry. Yes. It's, I don't know. Just do it. And then let us know what you think. So we went around for a while. We saw big stuff.
Yeah.
We saw, you know, the moose and the buffalo and the bison and the zebras. We did not see the small stuff that you're capable of catching and killing.
Didn't see it.
It's hide. It hides.
It's funny because I read a lot of romance novels.
Yeah.
And there's the particular one where it's, you know, there's a man and he lives on the edge of nowhere in, you know, the Wild West.
Oh, and doesn't he always have like 10 fish hanging from something?
Well, he has a mail order bride who comes from a city from the east who doesn't realize how rugged it is.
Yeah.
The first time he cooks her like a squirrel on a stick, she's horrified, but then her hunger pain overcome and she realizes
her hunger pangs. My stomach growled and I knew I had to try it.
Ugh. Right. And then she realizes how good it is and this and that. And I'm always like, just eat it. You'll die. Come on. Let's be more practical. Actually, there was one where it was really cute because the whole point was that he was managing to raise his family after his wife died. But there's all these little things like, you know, his wife would bake and he was not, you can't bake if you're also taking care of the farm because it requires like letting it rise and like being in the kitchen. So when his mail order bride comes and she bakes, it's like, this is something we've been missing. Like nobody bakes anymore because who's staying in the house to bake? So it was cute. And it's again, the love language.
Well, that's the love language. We said we were going to talk a little bit about our upcoming Hanukkah episodes. And in one of them, we're going to be talking to one of the authors, maybe more, because we also have an email from Mindy Klasky we have to reply to. Sorry, Mindy. She's one of the compilers of the Eight Kisses anthology about the Eight Kisses romances, which, by the way, when we say romance, we mean they're like physical romances.
Boom, chicka, mau, mau, people.
They're full on. And there's like Hot Scotsman.
Ooh,
and the Hot Scotsman wants to bake for the Jewish girl. because, yeah, as you pointed out, that's his love language.
Well, there's a lot of food in that book, actually. Almost every story, because there's latkes, there's sufganiyot, there's people baking bread. There's one where he's Italian, and so it's all pasta dishes, and his family, his mother knows whether or not they're serious about each other, whether she'll let him get a plate of food for her. Because she said, if you're willing to let him take care of you by letting him get you a plate of food, then you're in this relationship. And if you're not, then you're not, and you might as well book it. And so she bluntly tells the girl, like, I see you're not even in it, so what are you even here for? So, like, it's interesting. Like, food is...
That's true.
A love language for a lot of cultures, not just ours.
Yeah.
And so, and you can tell, like, are you bake worthy? Am I going to bake and bring you fresh food? Or am I going to pick up something from the store? Like, it says something. Like, there's nothing wrong with picking up something from the store, but it definitely says something different.
Oh, you should have seen my husband's paranoia after everyone ate the meat that he made.
Aww.
He goes, did everyone really like it? Or is it like when we don't like something at other people's houses and we just pretend to? And I go, honey, there was none left. That's how you know.
Oh, so I made cornbread stuffing for Thanksgiving, and I took it to a friend's house.
Did you look around to see who was eating it? Because that's how you love people.
I did, and the corner was gone, and that was it. And I was a little disappointed. Aww. Because it took a lot. You have to make cornbread, first of all. Then you crumble up the cornbread. You mix it with vegetables and sausage, and you bake it again. So
it was not for them.
I cooked it in a cast iron. I did this stuff. So then my friend's like,
the crap out of that.
Wait, so then my friend's like, your stuffing was the best. It was the hit of Thanksgiving. I was like, what are you talking about? When I left the corner, she's like, yeah, as soon as you left, all the kids went for round two and they demolished the stuffing.
Now, yay.
When you're sitting at the table and there's so many things to choose from, like, you just don't.
But see, I think stuffing first.
Right. So then later when they came back, they just
went for the stuffing.
Went for it because it's sweet and it's just
everyone
delicious.
Loves cornbread and everyone loves
spicy
stuffing.
Sausage. And I use.
Oh, I want your recipe. Yeah, so you have good. To share with everyone. Yeah. Maybe I'll even do a thing where when my dad's making latkes, I'll record and use, and he can talk us through.
Oh, that's a nice idea.
Because he probably has the best latkes I've ever had.
Are they shredded or are they blended?
Both.
Ooh.
Boom.
Because my mom makes them. You put it in the food processor, so it's really a pancake. It fluffs up while you're cooking it.
Oh, his is both. So you know sometimes you get them and the shreds stick out the edges?
Yes.
His don't do that because it's a combo. So he makes, they're good. And he also tries to make the ones that are stuffed with brisket. And those don't come out the same way you want them to, by the way.
You know what? For science, I would try it, though.
For science, it's worth it. They're good. But what happens is the fat of the brisket leaks out a little and it burns the edges of the latke.
Like,
and if you like that, that's great. I like my latke to be evenly cooked around on all sides. And literally my dad's latke is like, everyone just kind of stands around the kitchen counter while he's cooking and he has to like bat you away with a spatula. Like, get away. So I'll use the excuse of bringing the microphone as an excuse to stand there and go like, and burn my mouth and burn the lid of my mouth while we're doing it. So it'll be good. And then we have some Hanukkah episodes coming up. We're going to be talking to kidlit authors. We are going to be talking to someone who works for PJ Library out of Hong Kong.
Ooh, nice.
She reached out to us. And the author of Chelm for the Holidays and what makes a good Hanukkah present for kids if you're going to buy them a book for one night, like what that book's going to be.
Right. And so this is the time of year that people, and I get these questions all the time. I'm the book Yenta.
Yeah.
And I've been doing this for years. People reach out to me. They're like, I need to buy a book for some person.
Yeah.
And so then I have to help them. Like, what do they like? Because what happens is a lot of times these are folks who they themselves read, but not necessarily different genres or different styles, and they're buying a book for someone who they don't know as well, or
it's
a different age.
That's
so
really
hard. So one of my friends, he's like, oh no, I need to bring a book for my like 13-year-old niece. What should I get her? Here's what she likes.
Well,
and so I was like, well, I don't know what she's already read, but here's a whole, and I gave him a huge list. I'm like, what about this one and this one and this one?
He's new
like,
stuff. So that's what we're going to also talk to soon. Hopefully Brianna from Intergalactic Guffy Coleman. Hopefully she'll be able to come talk to us, because that's one of the goals of her publishing company is that even a bubby who's out of touch should be able to trust that when they buy a book from Intergalactic Guffy Coleman, it's new and it's something that the kid will actually enjoy and that they don't have to like check the content.
Yes. So that's important to me as well, because I once bought my daughter a book and on the cover was like a girl with blonde pigtails wearing like a flowered dress. And then my daughter's like, Ima, this is not appropriate book. And I was like, what are you talking about? She goes, it's like they're in college or something. I was like, I'm sorry, what?
Sometimes that happens.
And I read the blurb and I looked and I didn't, whatever. Sometimes I'm very careful and I Google stuff, but there's just so much content. I just, sometimes something slips through the crack.
Yeah.
It looked like a little kid's book from the cover. It was pastel and she had a flower and she was pigtailed. Like I,
that's what YA books look like now. Yeah. YA books now have these very charming covers where they have like these little sketches of the characters kind of looking charming and cute, looking over each other's shoulders at each other, and oh, how sweet. And one of them's holding a flower, and one of them's holding a pen, and one of them holding a phone. And you open it and you're like, oh, this isn't for kids. It's YA.
Right.
So you do have to not look at the cover. Covers are changing.
Don't judge a book by its cover.
If you see a cover you love, obviously judge a book by, I'm saying age level, you can't judge a book by its cover anymore.
Yes.
Because even like, I see middle grade books that look like YA.
Yes.
And or even like adult books, like Sophia Pasternak's book, which have great food in it, by the way, lots of challah. She had a lot of challah in that book.
Oh, excellent.
That book looks like an adult fantasy book.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I just realized something.
What?
Totally off topic, but that's what we do here, is I'm at Third Place Books, and next to J.K. Rowling, the next letter in the alphabet is S, and there's no author in between her and the next letter.
Whoa.
Which means it'll be Emir Tsushim me.
Woo!
Is that good or bad? Do you want to be next to J.K. Rowling on the shelf or not?
Yeah, you do, because that's the kind of, that's like a comp, right? Like, you know.
Who do you sit next to on the shelf?
Who do you sit next to on the shelf?
The
even
fear.
Alphabetically, because, you know, especially like you're looking, what is you going to buy? Oh, there it is.
I don't know, it just scared me. I literally had like a panic moment. I'm like, oh my God, Emir Tsushim, please let my books out.
I'll
please
tell
let
you
my books
that
out.
When I go and I look for specific authors,
yeah.
I then browse everything around
near
them. Which means that there's an entire block of the alphabet I never get to because who's W? I don't know.
In the middle grade section, R is at a good height.
Yeah.
In the Y section, it's really high up. And in the adult section, it's also high up.
In
the middle grade, it's at a good height because I think they do it on purpose to put Harry Potter front and center. But it's so scary because it's like, and then my son says, how do you know?
Oh.
That you'll be on that shelf next to. I said, because God intends it. No, but like, really, it freaked me out.
Woo.
So everyone has to share with us how they pick out their books as gifts.
Yeah.
Because you're the bookend, you have a system.
I do.
It's more of an instinct than a system.
You know what, to be honest, I've read so many books that I can pull out things. I actually started, when I look for books to talk about in the podcast, I started doing a reverse search for commonality. So books that have fewer reviews, because you know what? I'm sorry. J.K. Rowling doesn't need me flinging her books at people.
No, she's
okay?
good.
She's
yeah.
good. Someone has heard of her. They don't need me to recommend it.
Right.
I'm going to recommend.
She's a fandom.
Exactly. If you haven't heard of Harry Potter, I can't help you.
Right.
But I want to recommend the books you maybe haven't heard of. Like, have you read Chris Colfer's books? And have you read this one? And have you read that one? Roald Dahl does not need me telling people that your kids should be reading Roald Dahl.
Well, that's why I like that in my Mystery Maccabee box, someone, Tamara sent me, she had no idea because she apparently did not search me up. Every year she gets me, and every year.
That's really cute.
Every year something happens that's magical in that box.
Yeah.
And last year it was that she put my favorite Shakespeare quote.
You really get the same person every year?
I got her last year.
That's really
the same. My favorite Shakespeare quote was on the cover of the journal she got me. And I was like, oh my God, though she be but little, she is fierce. And that's me.
You stalked me.
And I played her in high school. It was perfect. Then I thought she'd stalked me, but she hadn't. It was a coincidence. She said, you're a writer. I put it in. And then this year it was, I've been desperately looking for Naomi Novik's Spinning Silver.
Yeah.
And there it was in the box. She read it. She thought I might enjoy it. I've posted so many times online, who has this book to lend me? Because the library always has it out.
Yeah.
And there it was.
Yay.
So I thought, I'm going to put something secondhand in addition to the things I purchased in my box to send to my person. Because maybe it'll be something, not a book, but something else for their collection that they've been missing.
Yeah.
And so I did that in hopes that some magic happens and that they don't go, ugh, secondhand item. Like, I hope that they look at, in addition to the new stuff, they go, wow. So if you have a book for the holiday that you want to pass along to someone, secondhand is good.
Yes, of course.
It means you would love it and you want them to love it too.
Yes, exactly. So if you have a book recommendation that you think would make a good gift, drop us a line.
Yes, please tell us what we should talk about exactly for what to give as gifts. We're talking cookbooks, Hanukkah books, children's books,
but
anything.
Do people like getting bookmarks? Do they not like getting bookmarks?
Yeah, because we're
like,
sending, I have a few to mail out from people who commented or DM'd me on Instagram. So that's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, what do people want to get that's book related for Hanukkah? And we'll do a whole Hanukkah gift episode Hanukkah.
Before Hanukkah. We're getting there.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on this crazy wild ride.
And you can find us on Instagram at Kiddish Book Club. And I'm Yonit DM on Instagram, Twitter, and everywhere. And
she's Yonit everywhere. even here, sitting next to me on this couch.
I'm Yonit.
And I'm Hoffman Jess on Twitter. And you can, at me or DM me or whatever.
Just don't slide into my DMs unless you're nice. If you're a creeper, like
my
the
DMs
last guy.
Are super sweet, except for occasionally it'll be like, "Hello, beautiful. Here is my tush." I'm like, that's
no, thank you.
Pass. So if you're gonna slide into my DMs,
be nice.
Ask me book questions.
Yeah,
I like to help people, and because enough people have helped me. That my DMs are for giving people book recommendations and taking book recommendations.
Yeah. And people keep saying, "Oh, we want to talk to you on your show," but then those people disappear again. So if you really want to talk to us,
then talk to
us. Available.
Come find us. Come find us. Thank you for joining us today.
Have a good night.
Good night.
L'chaim.
L'chaim. Malkeinu, Moshiyeinu, Elokeinu, Avinu, Malkeinu, Moshiyeinu, Elokeinu, Avinu, Malkeinu, Moshiyeinu, Elokeinu, Avinu.